Title of the sermon is A Greater Righteousness. We are working our way through the Sermon on the Mount, the most powerful words of discipleship ever spoken. In the words recorded by Matthew, we have Jesus raising the bar on his audience of the first century. They had been living out the Mosaic law for about 1,500 years, but Jesus, God the Son, was giving the standard for the new covenant living. While we're here, and it is a greater righteousness indeed. This righteousness should have been the target for all Christians everywhere throughout the ages. But instead, much of the church has often softened these words by interpreting them away and ignoring them altogether. But in the following words, we find that Jesus' standard of holiness and life. These commands seem beyond us. Out of reach, and you can make sure of it, they are out of reach for us, apart from the work of God in our life. But we know from John's account that if we remain in Jesus, we can do all things in the kingdom as we remain in the vine. So Jesus continues this morning, explaining, commanding, and compelling, and willing us into holiness, into the greatest righteousness, until we look, what? Exactly like Him. He wants us to look like Him, nothing less. Jesus said, it is enough for the disciple to be like his teacher and the servant like his master. The outline breaks down into three parts, stated negatively by Jesus. We are not to divorce. Christians should never divorce. We are not to take oaths, and we are not to retaliate. I'm going to call on people to read throughout the course of our outline this morning, the sermon. So if you would, someone please read 31 through and 32, those two verses. From 1425 BC or so, the time of Moses through the first century in Israel, a man could divorce his wife by just what we would consider typing up a letter, typing up a statement, and coming home and handing it to her and say, I divorce you. It was considered to be the most civil and, dare I say, kind of trivial matter of the day. Didn't even involve the courts. Today, it's a lot harder to get a divorce. Back then, you just needed to give it to her in writing and hand it to her, and you're divorced. In fact, the Jewish law of that day demanded the termination of a marriage as well. If there was adultery, there was no recovery. If a man or a wife cheated, what we would call cheated, which it means to have fornication or adultery, during the betrothal or the wedding, the marriage was off. There was no reconciliation in that day. In Matthew 19, Jesus taught that Moses allowed the lesser standard, but Jesus cited the way God had originally intended, the text we had read, that Deborah read. Who read it? Joe read it. He said, Moses allowed it because of the hardening of your hearts, but it was not that way in the beginning. And he goes back all the way to the garden, pre-fall, to set the standard. Jesus introduced the new and shocking idea that even properly divorced, under the law of the day, if they divorced, they committed adultery. Marriage is meant to establish a personal and permanent relationship between a man and a woman, and divorce should therefore not be considered an option for the disciples of the kingdom at all. We need to raise the bar where it should be and keep it there as Christians. We need to teach others to do the same. God's ideal can be summed up in one simple sentence: one and done. One person for life, that's it. But God, as He set His standard for the church, you'd never know it in the life of the church. The church divorces at exactly the same rate the world does. People professing Christians divorce at exactly the same rate as unbelievers. There's no statistical difference. In fact, some are starting to say that the church divorces at a slightly higher rate. This ought not be the case. Jesus' standard is any divorce, there's adultery. There's either been a physical adultery or a divorce apart from an affair. What we call an affair is adultery. And we need to embrace that standard. See, as Christians, oftentimes we think divorce is not as bad as having an affair. Jesus said it's the same exact thing. Same exact thing. It ought to be scandalous for Christians to have a divorce, just like an affair is. But it's not. Church members have lowered their standards regarding divorce, and we must put it back, if that describes us this morning. Number two applicational point I would say is get it right the first time. Hey, look, the odds are stacked against young people. Our culture has developed so many pitfalls for young people, and we all know these things. But kids are entering puberty at around 11 years old. And they're staying in puberty, unfortunately, from a lot of immature activity till they're 25. So from 11 to 25, we got adolescence on our hands oftentimes. There are some exclusions, David. But it's rare. Oftentimes you see 25-year-olds, what are they doing? They're playing video games all the time, goofing off. They don't take to heart, when I became a man, I put away childish things. And in the Jewish culture, becoming a man, you started putting away childish things at when? What age? 13? Yeah. Bar mitzvah. Huh? I became a man. You become responsible. It's time to grow up. Start putting away childish things. I know men who still play with Legos. Hey, when you're young, Legos are cool. But when you're 30, maybe you should be focusing on some other things, right? So get it right the first time. I digress. Don't let me start talking about our culture, okay? Even in a Christian context. But listen, apart from being born again through faith in Jesus, marriage is the next most important decision we'll make as a human race. That's the next most important decision. Our trusting in Jesus, number one. But the next exact thing that is critical to your life, as far as a whole of humankind, is marriage. Who are you going to marry? And Christians ought to be dating to marry. That's it. You don't date just to date. You don't date to get to know a bunch of people. You date to marry. What does that look like? Well, dating to marry looks like this. What does your devotional life look like? That'd be the first question I would ask somebody if I was 20 years old and interested in a woman. I would say, what does your devotional life look like? Tell me your testimony. Tell me about how the Lord delivered you from your life of darkness. Tell me what the Lord's doing in your life right now. Today. Not you know, a couple years ago when you had, you know, a God rash. But what is He doing right now? How many kids do you want to have? How do you think a parent ought to handle a rebellious child? Would you allow a teenager to have internet in their bedroom? What do you consider to be a good home? Define that in every way possible. These are the type of things you do when you're dating. And when do you start it? After you fall in love? No, exactly not, okay? Too oftentimes Christians are so passive and their heart gets involved in the relationship before they've asked the first tough question. And it's no wonder that we end up with marriages that look like the world. God gives exactly one exception for the divorce, and that's adultery. You and I need to guard our heart, point number three. You and I have to guard our heart. You need to guard your heart as a single person, as a young person. We need to guard our hearts as spouses of people. We need to guard ourselves, married people and young people, against flirting, adulterous eyes. We talked about lustful images last week. We talked about that in great detail, and there were no young people in here, so that was razor sharp. Razor sharp, as it should be. Point number four, we need to stop sinning in our marriages that we do have. There is so much divorce in the American brand of Christianity because there is so much carnality in our marriages. It's just plain and simple. Just carnality. Worldliness. I've counseled. I've had the joy of doing marriage counseling. It can be a bitter pill as well. It's a heartbreaking endeavor at times. It's some of the best things you can do as well. It just depends on what happens. But I can tell you that anytime people come in for counseling in a marriage, there's sin. And it's just a matter of getting to the sin. Let's face it, does the American church look more like the Sermon on the Mount or the church at Corinth? Would you say the American church looks like the Sermon on the Mount or more like Corinth? Yeah, I rest my case. We as Americans, we are so wrapped up in the culture, so wrapped up in what the world cares about, so wrapped up in worldly thinking and living. There's no doubt in my mind why we have problems that we do. When we wake up, we ought to be focused. What's your goal when you wake up? Think about your goal. I'm not going to call on you. When you wake up tomorrow morning, what is your number one goal as a born-again Christian? What is it? Think about it right now. I mean, literally put it into words and think about it. What's your goal tomorrow morning? What's your goal today? If it's anything other than, God, I hope I look more like your son today, and that my life glorifies you, and that I'm a witness for you, and that I become a more committed disciple for you today, then our focus is off. Plain and simple. It boils down to the most simplistic ideas. When we wake up, are we committed to the things of Christ or committed to the ways of the world? And whatever our commitment is, that's the way our life follows. These things are weighty. They're the weightiest ideas in Christianity, and we see the Lord presenting these ideas. Right at the opening of the New Testament, the first sermon, Jesus starts laying out these hardcore truths. And yet, what does the church do? Well, let me explain it away. What that really means is, hey, just be married kind of like the world does it, you know, just figure it out. No! Our lives need to look like Christ, and we're not finished running our race. We're not finished making that end goal happen, and we have a participation in that. God does a heavy lifting through His Spirit, but we participate how? By being committed to what we read in the Word through prayer, devotion to God. When we are madly in love with Jesus, we want to go for the things of God. I promise you. And that's how cool Jesus has made it for us. I say cool because it is cool. It is absolutely just the greatest deal you'll ever get. I'll save you from your sin if you have faith in me. Deal number one. I'll make you look just like me as you fall in love with me. There's your Christian life. Fall in love with Jesus, and you and I will care about what He cares about. We won't have another lover, and we will excel in the things of God. What a great easy plan. You don't need to go to seminary for it. You don't need to go to church for it. That's it. It's a two-part plan. Trust Jesus, fall in love with Him. Let's go eat. Apply. Yeah? What a deal. I would say, too, that there are times where we need to get help. You know, I've seen married people, they're in trouble. And usually when somebody enters counseling, their marriage is an absolute train wreck or dumpster fire or whatever else you want to call it. I mean, usually it's like a mess from top to bottom. And then they're like, we better go get some help. And, you know, my grandma used to say, kids, you won't know what this means, but a stitch in time saves what? Yeah, nine. A stitch in time saves nine. Oftentimes, if we'll get on the problem early, then we won't see these other problems manifest. But there are times where we do nothing and we watch our marriages crumble right before our eyes over the years and we don't take any kind of action. It's heartbreaking. I would say, look, if your marriage is really getting out of whack, have you been to a marriage conference? Have you taken a weekend, got the kids farmed out, and you and your spouse taking off for the weekend and saying, we need some help, let's go just enrich our marriage, let's spend the weekend somewhere nice, let's go to a marriage conference? Have you done that? Oftentimes people say no. How many books have you read on marriage? You're having marriage problems. Are you reading any books right now on marriage that are from conservative Christian people that will drive you in the right direction in thinking? No, we're not doing that. You listening to sermons about marriage? Podcasts? You know, they got all these things called podcasts these days. You listening to marriage podcasts? No. No. And Dave Hodges, one of my mentors, he used to say, you know, people just come in, they hope you got a red pill in the desk drawer. And you sit on the desk and say, hey, take this, you'll feel better. Things will just work out. And it won't. There is no pill. There's Jesus. That's it. There's just Jesus. But I've also seen marriages healed. I've seen marriages healed in like 10 days. Like people on the edge of divorce, and there's a breakthrough because of introspection. What is going on with my dark heart that is causing the cancer in my marriage? And then when somebody turns their attention, instead of wanting to get their spouse, and they turn their attention toward their own heart and say, this is what I'm doing to bring the problems into my marriage. I've seen breakthroughs in 10 days. Like night and day couples. Just like that. Work of God. It's fascinating. It's awesome when that happens, but oftentimes it's a process. But marriage is easy when we're living in love. 1 Corinthians 13, 4 through 8a, very popular passage. I don't want to misread it. I could probably quote it, but then I might leave something out. Love is patient. Love is kind. It does not envy. It does not boast. It is not proud. It does not dishonor others. It is not self-seeking. It is not easily angered. It keeps no record of wrongs. Love does not delight in evil, but rejoices with the truth. It always protects, always trusts, always hopes, always perseveres. Love, what? Never fails. Never fails. Okay, I want you to imagine this for a second. I'm looking at my wife. I come into you for some marriage counseling. And you say, well, tell me what's good about your marriage. Well, let me tell you. My wife is patient. She's kind. She does not envy. She does not boast. She is not proud. She does not dishonor me. She puts me first. She is not easily angered. She has no record of any wrong in my past. She does not delight in evil. She rejoices with truth. She protects me. She trusts me. She hopes in me. She perseveres, and her love has never failed. And you would say, are you crazy? What's going on? Your wife's doing all that, and you're having marriage problems? See the impossibility of that? I would be driven out of that office as being bipolar. Some kind of label would be attached to me, for sure. What is going on with you, Monty? Your wife is acting perfectly, and where are you? There's no charge. If that passage didn't cover every detail of life, I don't know what passage would. It covers every detail. And when we are loving in our marriages, there is no grievance, not one. And it's a beautiful thing. And you know the marriages that have that, it's when Christ is right there with that couple. Christ is in the middle of that relationship. And that love is flowing from the throne of God into our hearts and out of our lives, to our family, to our community, etc. The next section that we're moving to is beautifully placed, I believe, by Matthew. It deals with oaths. And Christians often take oaths at weddings. So let's talk about it. Somebody please read verses 33 through 37. Another short passage, 33 through 37 of the Lord's Master Sermon.
Do not swear by your head, because you cannot make a single hair white or black. But let your yes mean yes, and your no mean no. Anything more than this is from the evil.
So what was said from of old? Well, we have Leviticus 19 and 12 and other passages. Leviticus 19, 12 reads, "You shall not swear by my name falsely, and so profane the name of your God. I am the Lord." Or I am Yahweh, if you prefer. To take an oath and not keep it was to take God's name in vain. So to use God's name, that's what a lot of people think, that a cuss word is using God's name in vain. Using God's name in vain is much more broad than that. It's using God's name where there's no appropriate comment that follows. It's just to use His name casually. That's what using God's name in vain actually means. It's not just a cuss word. It is that, but it's so much broadly. You know, even the term like, oh my God, that's using God's name in vain. It's using His name improperly. It's throwing His name around in a common way, which is the opposite of holy. Common is the exact opposite of holy. And God's name is only to be used in a state of holiness, period. And so you see the Levitical standard of do not swear falsely by the Lord's name. Oaths were common in the Old Testament, but here again we see Jesus raising the bar. I would take issue again with all the commentators that say Jesus was interpreting the Mosaic law. He was not. He is giving us New Testament doctrine in its purest form, obviously, when He speaks in this Sermon on the Mount. And He's raising the bar. You have heard it said. You have heard it said. Well, they weren't getting these things out of a vacuum. They were getting them out of the Mosaic law. And Jesus said, but I tell you. And then what is He doing constantly? Raising the bar. He's doing away with the old standard and bringing in the new standard. The standard that He will live by. So what's the church's standard? No oaths at all. Here Jesus gives us the benefit of His and an explanation. He says, one, in essence, we are not to swear by heaven because God owns it and makes His rules from there. We don't own heaven, don't swear by it. God also makes rules from there. We're not making rules from there. So it carries the idea that God is in charge of the world from heaven. God is using earth as His footstool. That's the idea. That's an illustrative idea, of course. But the footstool, God owns it. It belongs to Him. It's His property. Man cannot exchange the earth for his oath. And that's what oaths did. If you swore an oath by something, if you didn't come through, then you had to give something over. And God says, you can't give over the earth. Don't swear by it. It's my footstool. When you go home and put yourself up in the lazy boy, just think, man, that's God, that The earth down there, that'd be God's footstool. That's how he describes it. What an image. So what did Jesus mean? People cannot deliver God's property in exchange for an oath done poorly. We should not swear by our own bodies. Did you see it? And when we prayed this morning, we realize at times in great times of trial how very little control we have on our lives. Oftentimes, when everything's good, we think we got all kinds of control, don't we? And I got control over what shirt I wore today. I didn't pray about that. I just said, hey, that one will be fine. Grabbed a shirt, right? It makes me feel like I'm in control. And Jesus said, you know what, Monty? These last hairs are stubborn. Nope. Anyway, these hairs up here, he said, you can't change one of them a different color. That's how much power you have. If I were to personalize his message, he's saying, Monty, you can't change one little bitty hair on your head a different color. Clairol can, but you can't. I don't use Clairol. But he's saying, there's no power. You don't have any power over your life. Don't make an oath. So what's the standard? God requires truthfulness. Period. A simple yes or no should be all that is needed. When a Christian says yes, they mean yes, even when it hurts, even when it costs. We see a priority with this truth as explained by James, Jesus' half-brother, when he wrote to the church. And many of you remember this. But above all, James says, above all. This is in James 5:12. My brothers, do not swear either by heaven or by earth, by any other oath. Let your yes be yes and your no, no, so that you may not fall under condemnation. James says, the number one thing I want to leave you with is what Jesus preached in the Sermon on the Mount, what we would call the Sermon on the Mount. No oaths. He said, above all. Otherwise, you fall into condemnation. There's a penalty for using oaths for Christians. When we get to heaven, there's a great penalty for doing it. Jesus said to even do it was evil. There you go. It's evil. Don't do it. Can't identify the problem. Great quote here. By adding oaths to our statements, we either admit that our usual speech cannot be trusted, or else we lower ourselves to the level of a lying world. When we use any kind of oath, a promise, anything like that, to try to back up a yes or a no, then you and I fall into the trap of saying, you know, if I don't say that, then my yes may not mean yes. I could be lying. Or we end up going down into the world's ideas and having to bolster up our yeses and nos, because oftentimes the world lies. And oftentimes our yeses don't mean yes. Is it true or no? We throw that around so casually. And a lot of cultures, unfortunately, in the Oriental cultures especially, they struggle. They always say yes. It's part of their culture. Can you imagine that being your culture where you never say no? It's like uncouth to tell anybody no for anything at any time for any reason. They would have a lot more work here. But how often have we got sucked into that kind of idea where we don't want to just say no? No, I won't do that. Or yes, I will. Or I will consider that. We throw yes around casually. And Jesus says, when you threw that yes out, it meant yes. I'll clean my room tomorrow. Time to clean, right, boys? You ever heard that, boys? No? Oh my, okay, well, I had a dirty room. I heard it all the time. I made all kinds of promises. Yes, I'll clean it just later, Mom, later. But as Christians, we don't do that. Our yes is solid, our no is solid. There are no exceptions. Now, Constable, Calvin, Barclay, and others, they cited Jesus' trial as being an exception. Now, Jesus was put under an oath by Caiaphas. I didn't see their point. I mean, I saw it because he was put under an oath, but he did not take an oath himself. They also cite some of Paul's letters, Romans, 2 Corinthians, and 1 Corinthians also, as taking oaths. So, what's the application? And indeed, in court, if you were to testify, you may be required to take an oath. All right. Now, what I would do in that case is explain to the court and ask for a slight change in wording for a religious purpose. I would tell them that I'm instructed by the Lord Jesus that my yes is as good as an oath, and I'm instructed not to take an oath. Will you give me a religious exemption and just change the wording slightly to meet the religious practice that I have? And so it might look like something like, yes, I will tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help me God. There you go. Slight change. And we are also told to submit to authority. So if they say no, what if the judge says, no, I won't change the oath? You're required to take the oath as written. Well, then you're going to have to work out your faith there. I'm not going to call it for us. I'd have to call it for my own self. You have to call it for yourself. In the finer details where we don't have scripture, we have to walk by faith. And we have to make some decisions on our own. So that would be one. We also see oaths at weddings. We see vows and oaths at weddings. We shouldn't, not in a Christian context. There should have never been an oath or a vow at a Christian wedding since Jesus spoke these words. And James even warned the church. But yet, what are the church? What does the church do? The church acts like it doesn't read the Bible, which a lot of times it doesn't. Even pastors and teachers don't read the Bible much, don't know the Bible, don't even know the Sermon on the Mount, for heaven's sake. I mean, when a pastor don't even know what's in the Sermon on the Mount, that should be embarrassing. But I guess it's not. Yeah. And I'm not throwing rocks. I don't know the Bible like I should. I am throwing rocks, but I'm going to back off a little bit. I mean, who knows the Bible like we should? Who can raise their hand and say, I know the Bible as well as I could have up to this point? I can't raise my hand for that. But we shouldn't see vows at weddings. So make sure the pastor or the priest doesn't use a vow or doesn't have an oath statement. And if he does, refuse to be married by him. I will not be married under where I have to repeat a vow or an oath, period. Why? It's in the certain Sermon on the Mount. Right? And it would look something like this. I, Monty, take you, Deborah, to be my wedded wife. Till death do us part, etc., etc. I will do it. I will, or yes, that's sufficient. Why? Because our Lord has said it is sufficient and anything else is evil. Yes is giving your lifelong commitment in that situation. If you say there's going to be a death before one of us gets out of this thing, then by George, that's what it means. So yes equals do it. That's our character. When a Christian says yes or no, we ought to be able to take it to the bank. And let me tell you something. You and I ought to watch how often we say yes or no. We've just got to say, let me think about it. Can I get back to you perhaps? Or even that, we open the idea that we're going to get back, right? So maybe better is just, no, Cain, I don't want to do it. And maybe you never get invited back to go fish. I hate fishing, by the way, so never invite me. I never get invited to go fish again. It's okay. Hey, following our Lord has consequences sometimes, especially in a godless society. Our reputations ought to speak for themselves. The world ought to be able to look at Christians and go, what do they have that I don't? And in the American church, generally, that cannot be said. We do not look attractive. It's just like Jesus said, we have lost our saltiness. There is nothing flavorful about the church. There is no light in the church oftentimes. When the world looks at the church and we are acting like the world, there is nothing. There's just a waste of time on Sunday morning there. Why would I want to go there? And that's what I would say too if I was a lost person. If I see a church acting like the world, why would I want to go there? I've got better things to do on Sunday morning than go to a church with people that don't actually believe what they say they believe. Who wants to be around a bunch of people like that? It ought to not be the case. It ought to be love and joy and hope and faithfulness and character in the church. A character that is attractive and salty and brings light into a dark world. The sayings, I swear, or oh my God, all that stuff is forbidden. You and I, as we look at the Sermon on the Mount, we ought to be challenged to change our lives. Listen, this one sermon, you just read it, make a commitment to read it every day for a month. It'll change your life. That one sermon that was preached, that may have been a compilation of things Jesus said, we don't know exactly, but what we call the Sermon on the Mount, chapter 5 and 6 of Matthew, those words, just those, are a blueprint to look like Christ, to follow in His footsteps, and to be transformed in our own heart and mind in ways we can't understand now, and to be witnesses to the world and ready to make disciples.